From Pacifico Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Again and again, I was questioned to the officers, "Officers, let me know what we have done, what we did, what's our sin, what's our guilt?" But they said, "Oh, we will talk.
Today, a Democracy Now! Exclusive, the story of a Pakistani immigrant, a pro-democracy activist and human rights lawyer. Police raided his home in Queens, New York, arrested him, dropped all charges, then handed him over to the INS. He was deported on Election Day. Then, after the U.S. deports a Canadian citizen to Syria, the Canadian government warns some of its citizens about traveling to the United States. Then we'll go to the Texas-Mexico border, where people have crossed the border into Texas to remember the immigrants who have died as they tried coming into the United States. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Emboldened by Tuesday's electoral victories, the Bush administration has called on the United Nations Security Council to vote tomorrow on sending weapons inspectors back to Iraq. The resolution is expected to be approved as France and Russia have reportedly dropped their threat of a veto. The BBC is reporting that Chief Weapons Inspector Hans Blix is expected to travel to Iraq in less than 2 weeks to start inspections. The draft resolution does not require a second resolution before the U.S. invades Iraq. Fallout continues from Tuesday's election, where the Republicans regain the Senate, giving the GOP control over Congress and the White House. Missouri Democrat Richard Gephardt is expected to announce today he will not seek re-election as minority leader. Congressmembers Nancy Pelosi of California and Martin Frost of Texas have launched races to replace Gephardt. Pelosi opposed the war resolution. Frost voted for it. In Minnesota, late Wednesday morning, former Vice President Walter Mondale conceded defeat to Republican Norm Coleman in the race to fill the late Senator Paul Wellstone's seat. And in South Dakota, the Republicans came within a few hundred votes of picking up another Senate seat. But early this morning, Democratic South Dakota Senator Tim Johnson claimed victory after narrowly edging out his opponent by a mere 527 votes. With all but one of the Senate seats decided, the Republicans now control 51 seats in the 100-member Senate. The New York Times reporting that the Bush administration now plans to push forward a domestic agenda of tax cuts, creation of a vast Homeland Security Department, and the confirmation of conservative judges. Other agenda items likely include the privatization of state pensions by investing Social Security funds in the stock market, the promotion of faith-based charity for the poor, and the reintroduction of energy legislation incorporating plans to drill for oil in the Alaskan Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Vice President Dick Cheney still refuses to give up the list of names of those representatives of corporations he met with before he released the National Energy Plan. The Republican mood after Tuesday's election was captured in a memo by an aide to Bush, quote, "The unprecedented historic nature of last night's results cannot be overstated." Republicans are crediting presidential adviser Karl Rove for planning the strategy for the 2002 election almost from the first day that George Bush became president. In the spring of 2001, Rove began fundraising and recruiting candidates for critical House and Senate races. Sources told the New York Times Rove essentially controlled the Republican National Committee from the White House. It was Rove who insisted the president devote the last 5 days before the election on a 10,000-mile, 17-city, 15-state blitz. It was Rove who insisted Bush make a political stop in Minnesota only 9 days after the death of Senator Wellstone and campaign for his opponent, even after Bush had skipped the late senator's funeral. On Wall Street, the stocks for weapons companies jumped as investors bet that the Republican sweep of Congress would translate into steady profit growth for the sector. And finally, the nonpartisan Center for Responsive Politics reports that over 95% of U.S. House races and 75% of Senate races were won by the candidate who spent the most money.
Mm-hmm. والطفيل رسول الثقلين يا رب الطفيل رسول الثقلين.
You are listening to Democracy Now! Breaking the Sound Barrier. As the Republicans swept the House and the Senate, President Bush left little time before he moved to the UN Security Council and submitted a resolution for invading Iraq. The resolution, again, the draft, says that there does not have to be a second resolution before the U.S. invades and requires that Iraq comply with all weapons inspectors and release within 30 days all components that could be used for chemical, nuclear, and biological weapons. If and when the U.S. decides to carry out a massive attack on Iraq, the southern port city of Basra will be one of the major front lines. In many ways, it already is. Basra lies within the so-called no-fly zones imposed by the U.S. and Britain, and the people live under regular U.S. bombing. George Bush touts the Shiites of the South as potential U.S. allies in a future U.S. attack, but it's this area of Iraq that has suffered the most from U.S. policy. Basra has been one of the most fought-over territories in the world and was at the front lines of both the Iran-Iraq War and the Gulf War. Once again, its citizens are bracing for the worst. Democracy Now! Correspondent Jeremy Scahill and filmmaker Jackie Suen filed this report in their latest installment of Democracy Now!'s exclusive Iraq Journal.
For hundreds of years, Basra was called the Venice of the East. Sinbad the Sailor's adventures were launched from its shores. The city is connected by a web of footbridges and canals that empty into the Shatt al-Arab, a focal point of the Arab sea trade for more than 1,300 years. It endured both Ottoman and British occupation. Fishermen and boats line the boardwalk that houses 101 towering individual bronze statues. Each one is unique and modeled after an Iraqi army soldier killed during the Iran-Iraq War. They stretch down the boardwalk for a mile, all of them with their arms raised, fingers pointing accusingly toward the Iranian border, some 6 miles to the east. The statues serve as a haunting reminder that Basra has long ceased to be thought of as anyone's Venice. Basra has been one of the most fought-over areas in the world. It's a stone's throw from both Iran and Kuwait, and suffered tremendously during both the Iran-Iraq War and the Gulf War. Basra is the heart of Iraq's oil belt, one of the richest stretches of land on Earth, but its nearly 2 million residents see almost no benefit from Basra's black gold. The poor Jumeirah neighborhood is full of roads overflowing with raw sewage and garbage. The streets are packed with children playing among the trash and green pools of waste. The whole area reeks of excrement. Here lives the family of Abu Muhammad. He's worked throughout his adult life as an oil mechanic, servicing the country's vast oil industry. Yet the meager salary that he earns from his work barely allows him to feed his family of eight, including his 2 children with Down syndrome. Only one of the children can attend school, and the family lives in a rat-infested, decrepit hovel that can only be described as a cave. Apart from a ceiling fan and a broken TV, they have no electrical appliances. They recently sold their refrigerator and electric cooker to repair a wall that had crumbled. Abu Muhammad is a proud and dignified man. He sits on the cement floor in his home, stroking the head of Haider, his teenage son with Down syndrome, and he talks about Washington's threats to invade Iraq.
We don't accept any invaders. I belong to a tribe, and no matter what happens, I will defend them. Do the Americans think that by coming here they will have a picnic in Iraq? Even if an Iraqi has something wrong with his government and the land is invaded from abroad, he will defend it. The core of the problem is that somebody wants to take your home.
Abu Muhammad's wife interrupts.
This house is poor and destroyed, but it is very dear to us. We will defend it and we will not give it to anybody.
Across the street from the family of Abu Muhammad lives another family that survives on the outskirts of Iraq's oil industry. Majid and Karima and their 4 children live in a 2-room shack. Majid is a struggling artist, and their home is filled with his paintings of Imam Ali, one of the holiest figures in Shiite Islam. Majid walks with a limp. During the Gulf War, he was driving in a carpool to the factory where he was working when a missile hit the road in front of them. Three of his co-workers were killed, while Majid and six others sustained injuries. He shows us his leg, left disfigured by the attack. Like almost everyone in Basra, Majid and Karima do not speak about war in the future tense. They live within the so-called no-fly zones imposed by the U.S. and Britain, allegedly to protect Shiite Muslims like them from Saddam. But Majid and Karima say they do not feel safer because of America's missiles. Like most families here, they sleep outside in a fly-infested courtyard on rotting mattresses near their outhouse. At night, they hear the thunder of Washington's planes. Majid says when they hear the roar of the planes, he feels powerless to help his wife, who says she collapses when they come.
I feel sick when I hear the planes flying above. I cry. I have psychological shock. I can't sleep. I listen to the radio and I feel scared. We are asking God just to save us.
In Washington, George W. Bush speaks of his love for the Iraqi people, saying he has no quarrel with them. But Karima and Majid wonder if Bush ever considers their children, robbed of their childhood by 12 years of war and sanctions. Across the street, Abu Mohammed says he doesn't talk to his children about what may lie ahead.
What am I supposed to tell them? That there'll be a war and you'll be dead?
All over Iraq, people speak of defending the country against an American invasion. But nowhere did this ring more true than when we spent time in the home of Abu Mohammed, his wife, and their six children, in the poor Jumeirah neighborhood in the port city of Basra. For now, they continue the daily struggle to make ends meet, knowing that someday in the not-too-distant future, they may have to defend their poor, destroyed home from foreign invaders. For Democracy Now!, this is Jeremy Scahill in Basra.
And you can see and hear more of Jeremy Scahill and Jackie Suen's reports at democracynow.org, iraqjournal.org. Special thanks to Rick Rowley of Big Noise Tactical Media for helping with the transmission of that report that we get regularly over the internet. Jeremy Scahill and Jackie Suen, among the only reporters who are now traveling through Iraq. You are listening to Democracy Now! As we listen to the voices of people on the ground, everyday Iraqis. Coming up in the next Iraq Journal, we'll hear from an Iraqi artist talking about what it means to create art at ground zero, being the target of the number one superpower on Earth. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. Welcome, Juan.
And good day to all of our listeners around the country on this momentous week after this election that we've just all witnessed. It was quite a continuation of the same right-wing drift that America has been undergoing now for many years. And of course, troubling to a lot of progressives in the country. But I think that when you analyze it and when you look at what has happened, there are quite a few still bright spots that people have to pay attention to, rather than just the overt signs that we're seeing of this rightward drift.
When I read the news of Dick Gephardt stepping down today as the House Minority Whip, as the Democratic leader in the House, I thought of the headline, Democrats Defeat the Democrats, on Tuesday, and what happened when the war resolution was being considered by Congress. Congress members looked up, Democratic Congress members, expecting to see their leader, Dick Gephardt. Instead, they saw on C-SPAN that he was over at the White House joining with President Bush in supporting the war resolution. And it's interesting to note that those who are battling now for the leadership of the Democratic Party in the House are Nancy Pelosi of California, who voted against the war resolution, and Martin Frost of Texas, who voted for it.
And I think increasingly some things have obviously been, it's been noted that the South now is increasingly the solid Republican base, whereas, of course, once it was called Democratic, but it was Democratic only in name only because it was largely a more racist wing of the Democratic Party that used to rule the South. So now all of those, that has now become a largely Republican bastion, and The other issue, of course, is the turnout. Turnout, I think, will prove to have been at historic lows, although because of the absence of all these exit polls, it's hard to tell yet. But certainly in New York, it was at a near historic low, and I think throughout the rest of the country, precisely because the Democrats didn't offer anything of substance that for the American people to see a real choice on. And the other interesting thing, of course, is that the Democratic Party has become increasingly more and more Black and Hispanic. There were several new Hispanic Congress members elected. Linda Sanchez in a new district in Los Angeles joins her sister Loretta Sanchez, now as the only sister team in the history of the House of Representatives. And you had Raul Grijalvas in Arizona, in southern Arizona, in the area around Tucson, a very liberal Democrat who was elected. And you had, unfortunately, a right-wing Republican in Miami, Mario Diaz-Balart, the brother of Lincoln Diaz-Balart. So you now have a Cuban right-wing conservative brother tandem in Miami. And interestingly, in South Texas, Henry Bonilla, the only Latino Republican in Congress, has been there for many years, was defeated by a far more liberal and actually an activist Chicano from South Texas. That was a change. But so for the most part, there's been an increasing number of Blacks and Hispanics now in the Congress, and eventually that will, I think, have some impact on how the Democratic Party functions. But right now, most of the news on the surface appears pretty grim. I think that the fact that there are so many disaffected voters who didn't see either party representing anything that they chose to come out for, still, there's a great opportunity there for a progressive movement to continue to build.
Well, there were other things happening on Election Day besides people going out to vote, overwhelmingly in this country, people not going out to vote. I think the figure is around a third of the registered voters went out, and let's not forget that how many people are not registered who could vote. But today we're going to talk about another Election Day story, one that has not yet been reported by any media outlet. It's the story of a pro-democracy activist and human rights attorney from Pakistan. He was deported on Election Day. He asked us to call him by the pseudonym Alex. In Pakistan, Alex worked with pro-democracy activists as an attorney. He represented minorities and oppressed groups. Around 3 years ago, he fled Pakistan after receiving an increasing number of threats, as he was quite critical of the leader there, Musharraf. He entered Canada on a Canadian visa but was refused permanent immigration status.
He then crossed the border into the United States without the proper papers. He moved to Queens, New York, and took a job as a security guard. Police officers raided Alex's home a few months ago. They found a booklet on helicopters and accused him of having a false ID and being a terrorist. The charges were dropped, but Alex was then handed over to the INS. He was imprisoned for 2 months and finally deported on Election Day. Democracy Now! Senior producer Chris Abrams spoke with Alex just a few minutes before he was deported. She asked him to tell his story.
Second week of June 2002, somebody knocked my apartment. I was opened the door, and I saw that four or five undercover people that stood there. They asked me, that gentleman, who you have a complaint that you always your door was ajar. I said, you see, I have opened the door, and you said that it was ajar. And they rushed inside, and they put me outside. I said, what's going on? Let me know, because I'm a peaceful person. I want to help you. They said, keep quiet and sit down over here. And another my colleague was inside, and they put him also outside, and they ordered me to sit on the floor outside my apartment. The attitude that time was very harsh and not cooperative. Rather than that, they ordered us, and they want to be dominate us by their attitudes, by their speaking, etc., etc. They show again and again as there's weapons and their badges, and they are talking about some Arab groups, which we don't know who was there. But they want to be try to, again and again, try to listen me, look, this and that you know these people. I said, listen, I'm an educated person. You can see everything inside my, I'm a peaceful person. We believe on a democracy. We believe on a peace. So if you think that we are a person like this, so there are many good places to live for us. But we are working hand over hand. We are just surviving because bad country, we don't have a good circumstances. But they don't believe us. Instead of the belief, they start their operations, they put everything, they disturb inside the furnitures, open the floors, and destroy my computers, my cells, my home videos. Oh my goodness, when they called me, like after 4 hours when I went inside, I saw there was just mess over there. Everything is mess to each other. I said, but that time they asked me that this is your name. I said, I'm not this guy. He's talking about the one guy. I don't know who was that. He said, no, you are this. I said, listen, believe me. He said, no, you're lying. You are this guy. I said, no, I'm not. And please speak nicely with me because we are very nice with you. And you're not supposed to be speak like that. And after that, they said, okay, who is this guy? I said, this is me. He said, you belong to some chopper institute.
Talking about a helicopter institute?
Yeah. I just wrote 2 years before to a helicopter's institute that I want to be interesting to get in training because in our back country, it is just a dream to become like helicopters or commercial pilot like this and that. So I like to be like this. So I just wrote them that I want to be. That was, it's a question of before 9/11. So they sent me all these things, but due to lack of finance, I was not turned back myself. They said, look, you guys have a fake license, etc., etc. I said, this is a license. This is ID. You can check immediately. No, you are living in an atomic cage. You have every facility. You just turn the button and can, confirm it.
But so you're saying they accused you of, or they brought up two issues. They said that your ID was fake, and they said that you were interested in training as a helicopter pilot.
Actually, they rushed my apartment without thinking. I don't know why they come, because they are focused once in a fake side. So second time, they focus their attention on helicopter size, and then they allege us that we are a terrorist. Basically, they don't know why they are coming over there. Sometimes they call us terrorists, sometimes they call us like that we are using forgery, sometimes they informed us that we belong to this institute, this and that. We don't know what's going on because it was very new and strange for us, right? So basically that time the team who raided on my apartment, they are unable to decide that what basically focused that one. So after that they allege all these things and they put us with a cuff. And turn us in a station, police station. There's, they took our all fingerprints, photographs, etc., and they issue my docket number, etc. Again and again, I was questioned to the officers. Officers, let me know what we have done, what we did, what's our sin, what's our guilt. But they said, oh, we will talk.
What were the charges, and did they have a warrant?
Oh, no, that time they are not. That time... I just asked them that, did you have a search warrant? They replied me ambiguous. But I was sure that time they don't have search, because if they had that time, they have to show me that, oh, yes, we have. But I thrice asked them that, gentlemen, you have a search warrant? They said, like this and that, and they try to be change the point. But I was darkly sure that they don't have that time. But later on, I came to know it was... also on the record, please, that basically they are not coming for us. Some respectful peoples who informed that few Muslim peoples are living on that floor, so you have to check them because they look like terrorists. Means our face, our colors, our name is just identification of a terrorist. Everybody think that if we have Muslim name means we are a terrorist. If we have an Asian face, it means we are a terrorist. We are facing many brutalist mind peoples, and basically they told, and someone informed me later on that basically they are coming for another purposes on our buildings, but due to the complaint of some white peoples, the brutalist peoples, they informed them that on that floor some Asian peoples are living, and they are sure that we are belong to them, and they came to just for their complaints.
We will call him Alex, a Pakistani immigrant who was deported on Election Day from New York. When we come back from our break, we'll be joined by attorney Michael Ratner to talk about the police raid on his apartment. Then we'll hear Alex describe what happened after the police dropped all criminal charges, why he wasn't simply released. Stay with us. You're listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report, looking at immigrants today and the America that they live in and are deported from. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. Michael Ratner is president of the Center for Constitutional Rights. We're going to hear in a minute what happened to Alex, the Pakistani immigrant deported on Election Day, after all criminal charges against him were dropped. But what about this raid of his apartment?
Well, good morning, Amy and Juan. I mean, his story, unfortunately, is really typical of what has happened since 9/11 to people from certain countries, people of certain religions. You get a tip from somebody who just doesn't like the way they look or their color or what country they're from. The police go and try and arrest the guy or go see the guy with no evidence whatsoever. In his case, what the cops did is they just, the door was apparently slightly ajar, but that doesn't give the cops any right at all to go in. They have to ask permission to go in, or they have to have a warrant. They didn't. They then go in, and they rip the apartment to shreds. I mean,
you heard him say they ripped up the floorboards.
Yeah, I mean, this was, and they had no evidence other than some guy saying, you know, some person saying, he said white people saying there, well, there's some Muslims living in my apartment. And that's what this country has become for non-citizens, particularly from certain countries and of a certain religion. And when I talk about living in a police state, maybe for me it's not a police state, but for non-citizens from certain countries, that's a story, you know, that you would have read about in, you know, some totally fascist country where the cops go into an apartment, raid the place, tear up the floorboards, and then arrest the people and stick them in jail with no charges. That's what we're talking about.
And, of course, the expectation is that because they're not citizens, that their likelihood of their following following through with complaints or filing civil suits against their mistreatment is unlikely, isn't it?
Well, we try very hard to represent them and file suits, but of course it's much less likely. I mean, non-citizens in this country that I am on panels with are frequently afraid to speak out because they're afraid the government is going to go after them just for their free speech. So the idea of filing a lawsuit for these people is very difficult.
If Alex had said no when the police came to the door, I mean, if they didn't have a search warrant, what would have happened then?
Well, I think those guys were going in anyway. That sounded to me like those guys just said, they just pushed past and went in. They weren't going to mess around. I mean, I think that's what they do in these cases.
So they said once they went inside, he had a false ID, but then those charges were dropped because the ID was valid. But let's hear what happened after the charges were dropped and the what the police do then. This is, well, we call him Alex, being interviewed by Democracy Now! Senior producer Chris Abrams just before he was deported.
And so you were arrested, you were fingerprinted, handcuffed, taken in, and what happened then?
After that, they put us in a cell in a police station. After 6 hours, they all again called us that this and these guys came, and they collect in a van. That time I again asked them that let me know where we are going. No, because we have to know what's our destination. Where are you bringing us? They said right now you are going in a Queens house, in a Queens County jail.
That's Queens County, New York.
Yeah, you're right. So we were over there, and they took again our photographs, fingerprints, and they put us in a very cool, freezing cell. who complained a thousand times that, look, this is inhuman things that you are bringing us, our hairs least, and because that time, it was the month of June, and we are wearing very short clothes, like due to summer. But what happened? We complained again and again, but nobody cared about us. After that, we was represented before the court, before the judge, and there we saw that we are facing these charges, fake documents, terrorism. My goodness, who was to be a burden that was going on? We are very peaceful peoples, but we are alleging only for the one complaint? And they believe that, guys, and they don't believe us. Even they are nothing find anything over theirs. But they are still insist themselves that we are that guys, which they believe some complaining, but they don't believe us.
Who did they say you are? You said that they called you a terrorist?
Yeah, because when we present before the judge, it was an allegation upon us that we are promoting the terrorism. But what means? We don't know, and they don't know too.
Okay, so you are in a cell in Queens County Jail. What next?
And after that, our attorney was request to the court that these are innocent guys. They don't have a criminal back records. They are peaceful people. So you can ask the neighborhood, etc., etc. And meanwhile, they are able to appeal. But that time, judge denied. He said, no, who will see the next? And then he put 2 weeks after, he reset the new date. And that date, police officers came in our cell, correction officers, and he said that 2 days your court date. And he woke us early in the morning, like 4 o'clock early morning. And then after different procedures, we came down. And we spent whole day in the jail. And like 6 evening, we came to know that we are on a dollar bail bond. And now we are going to be handed over to INS. So after 17 days, INS came over there. And they hold us. And they put us with the handcuffs, with the foot cuffs, with the belly cuffs. And I said, what are you doing? They said, this is a procedure, gentlemen. We have to do like this. And then they put us, INS, they put us in on their Varick Street, some stations. They put again our fingerprints, photographs, etc. And then one correction officer came to me. He said, Mr., you know, we will not provide you a lawyers because this is not a criminal case. I told him, okay, I understand what you mean, but you don't understand. I am a backcountry lawyer. I have a good command of law, and I know better the legal histories of the world. If you are involving in a civil case rather than the criminal case, you are not supposed to bind me in a handcuff, in a foot cuff, and a belly cuff. What's going on? One hand, you are saying that this is not a criminal law, but the other hand, you are treating me as a criminal. He said, this is a procedure. I said, you need to change it because you are living in an atomic cage, and you are the good example for the world that America is a democracy, father, mother of the democracy, etc., and this is a free land, but you are doing something very stupid thing. You have to change these things. But he said, okay, we are not ready to hear you right now, but this is a procedure we have to do. But they did. They cuffed me, and they put us next time in a Middlesex. And we face over there like months in a Middlesex.
So you're saying they dropped the criminal charges on you and handed you over to the INS, and you were taken to Middlesex County Detention Center in the care of the INS?
Yeah, actually, they couldn't find anything because we are pure and neat persons. We are not criminals. We are not relating wrong activist persons. So ultimately, they came to know that we are peaceful, so they dropped our charges. And they released, our case was closed and sealed. And they admitted that we are nice guy. But meanwhile, INS has completed his actions. By that actions, I go to voluntary departure, and I was compelled, I have to go back my country.
Why is the INS deporting you?
They have different kind of reasons. And we want to be justified then, that we came here to came dreams true, because we heard that America is the land of opportunity. America is the land of dream came true. And we are coming here to complete our goals. I want to narrate the whole story to the courts. But again, courts, they are not supposed to be see behind their nose. They are have to follow their procedures. And I also observed there that the conduct of the court is not friendly with me also, because that court is contained, the judge was white. My lawyer was white. And they, when they heard me, when they look my names, the prejudice was height at once appear. And I observed that time that I'm unable to get justice from these courts.
A Pakistani immigrant, we'll call Alex, talking on election day just before he was deported, about after police dropped criminal charges against him after raiding his apartment without a search warrant and being held in a prison cell. He was handed over to the INS. Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, what about this relationship between the INS and the police and not knowing what the charges were against him?
Well, the first thing that's remarkable is the guy is held for 17 days in a prison when there's no charges and really, I mean, essentially as a criminal with no getting out. I mean, it's unheard of. I mean, it's just, I mean, it's basically treating a non-citizen as a non-person. I mean, like a piece of furniture or something, sticking him in there. Then they find there's no charges and they decide, well, he was an illegal immigrant, so we'll turn him over to the INS. Now, in the old days, what would have happened is they either would have done nothing. You know, we have 4 million people in the United States who have something wrong with their visa. But because he's from Pakistan, they decide, well, turn him over to the INS. And normally, even when you got turned over to the INS would give you an immigration hearing right away and set a parole or a bond and release you on the street while your application for whatever was pending, either to be deported or for political asylum or for what. But because he's from Pakistan, they don't do it anymore like that. You get turned over to the INS, you never see light after you get turned over to the INS. You get put in a prison, this one in Middlesex, New Jersey, where there's hundreds of people like him, hundreds, maybe thousands in the United States like him, get no attorney, and basically go through a process that's Kafkaesque.
And they're all in these small town jails. I know Wayne in Pike County, Pennsylvania, is another one, right, where there's a whole bunch of people that, and they're basically sent off so that you can't even find them in an INS detention facility because they're subcontracted out to these local jails that don't have enough prisoners in their jails.
No, that's how they do it, mm-hmm, to make money for the prison. It's very hard to get attorneys there. We've had families wait for a week to try and, you know, in a U.S. attorney's office or an attorney's office from the government to say, where's my person? Where is my husband? Where's my father? Where's, you know.
And although it's not a criminal case, and he's treated like a criminal, he doesn't automatically get the right to a lawyer. So he's just got to find from word of mouth who he could get to represent him. In this case, Alex got one lawyer who told the judge before ever consulting Alex that he would agree to be voluntarily deported. And then he got rid of him, and the second lawyer said when the judge asked, does he face any persecution at home, he said no. Well, this is what Alex had to say about his activities in Pakistan. And remember, Alex was a human rights activist and attorney.
So I have a legal background, so I have to respect the court, and I don't want to be the violation. So even I'm not ready in these circumstances, but I have to leave because I got an order of the courts, which is not suit to me. But I am again and again explaining here that I want to be obey the law. I want to be show them that I'm peaceful. I am obedient of the law. So if they gives me order, even this is not suit to me, but I am going to be obeyed.
Can you talk about the kind of work you did in Pakistan and why you came to the United States?
Basically, I was a lawyer over there, and we represent many minorities over there who were suffering under the prejudice, some groups, and we represent them. I worked for the suffering minorities back in my country. It was only reported cases. I worked for the labor-bonded peoples, which is illegal. I work for the child labor, which is also still illegal. And we work for the suffering people. I work for the peoples who want to be, work against the drug mafias. I work for the people who want to be rehabilitated them, and they want to be quit the heroines. So by that all activities, I create many, many enemies over this. Because if I am working against the minorities, the some privileged groups become enemy of me. They don't want to be seen like this. If I am working for the boundary labor, some feudal-minded peoples became enemy of me because I am snatching their labors. If I am working against the child labor industrial peoples, they don't like me. So if I am working against the drug mafia, of course they are my enemies again. So by these all means, there were so many peoples who are apparently my friend, but in fact they are my enemies. And I was suddenly came to know that the rope is going to be tied against me, and the circle and the ring is very, very close to me, and maybe I will be a victim of some unknown bolt, and then I will be in the books of the history that I was work for this and then. So by these all enmities, I was compelled.
You've been listening to Alex, an immigrant from Pakistan, who was arrested by the police, all criminal charges dropped, but then handed over to the INS to port on election day. Finally, our producer, Chris Abrams, spoke with a well-known immigrants advocate who is director and co-founder of the Coney Island Avenue Project. His name is Asanullah Khan. And this is what he had to say about Alex's case in the context of how many, particularly Pakistani men, are being arrested and picked up in their communities daily.
On Coney Island Avenue in Brooklyn, can you estimate how many people are arrested every day, every week in this neighborhood?
On average, every day, there are 3-4 people, those are being arrested, every second day. And every day, the Pakistan International Airline is taking about 4 or 5 people. Those are being deported. So this is everyday story.
Bobby Khan, if there's a way that people can help, is there a website or a phone number people can call for more information?
Yeah, we have an office space on the Coney Island Avenue. Our office address is 1117 Coney Island Avenue. And our office number is 718-859-0238. Our fax number is 718-859-0465.
And that is Bobby Khan, Asanullah Khan, director and co-founder of the Coney Island Avenue Project. When we come back, we'll find out why Canada is warning its citizens about traveling to the United States after a Canadian citizen was secretly deported to Syria by the U.S. Stay with us. You are listening to Democracy Now! Breaking the sound barrier, I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. Last week, the Canadian government issued an unusual warning for a number of its citizens. Beware of traveling to the United States. The travel advisory was directed toward Canadian citizens born in Iran, Iraq, Libya, Syria, Sudan, Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, and Yemen. It came after the U.S. secretly detained a man who's both a Canadian and Syrian citizen in New York. On September 26th, the man, Maher Arar, was in JFK Airport on a stopover flight from Tunisia to Montreal. He was detained and interrogated for 9 hours without a lawyer. Officials claimed he had ties to a terrorist organization He was then detained at the Metropolitan Detention Center in Brooklyn.
The Ottawa Citizen reports that 6 days after he was scheduled to land in Montreal on October 3rd, Mr. Ahrar made a desperate and emotional phone call to his mother-in-law, telling her that he had been jailed and needed help. The family contacted Amal Uma, an immigration lawyer based in New York. On her October 5th visit with Mr. Ahrar, Ms. Uma found that he was confused, scared, and emotional. He spent much of the visit sobbing uncontrollably, she said.
Around October 10th, U.S. officials deported him. He was sent first to Jordan and then to Syria, where he has not lived in 14 years. He's now being held in a Syrian prison. His family was never informed. Canadian officials were not informed but have met with Ahrar now in Syria. His family has been denied contact. The Canadian government has backed away from its travel advisory after the U.S. assured them that the policies no longer apply automatically to Canadian citizens. The family of Maher Ahrar is still fighting for his release and to learn what happened. We turn first to Monya Azig, who is Maher Ahrar's wife and the mother of two children, age 6 and an infant. She is currently in Tunisia. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
Can you tell us what you know at this point and why your husband was taken at JFK Airport and then ultimately deported to Syria where he's in prison?
As your reporter said, it took me 5 days to know that he has been arrested. Nobody could tell me where he was when I started looking for him. When I knew that he was arrested, obviously we started contacting lawyers, but I never had a chance to talk with him. The only thing I knew, it was through the Canadian Council in New York. She went once to visit him, and he showed her a piece of paper with some allegation written on it. It was said that he was inadmissible to the U.S. because he was native of Syria, because he was not a U.S. citizen, and because he was a member of a terrorist group. By the way, he never tried to enter the U.S. He was only on transit. And the second thing is that if they have such an allegation against him, the basic, democratic rule would say that he must be in front of a judge and try to defend himself and try to show that these allegations are not, they are not founded. But the U.S. government never did that. It seems to me that I'm not sure if they found these allegations serious or not, but for me they are not serious.
And for what reason have the Syrian officials jailed him?
I don't know. This is the question I'm asking myself, but my assumption is that the U.S. government must probably send him with some reasons. I mean, they could not accept someone without without any charges or any allegation. But so most probably he has been sent to Syria with some allegation from the U.S. government. So most probably he's been interrogated for these allegations.
Riyad Saluji is also on the line with us from Canada, the executive director of the Council on American Islamic Relations Canada. How typical is this?
Well, this is an atypical case. You know, there's no other case that we know of where a Canadian citizen was deported back to his home country. Mind you, there are a number of cases that are similar in tone, meaning that there have been many, many cases, especially that have come to light of late, having to do with racial profiling at the U.S. border, where Canadian Arabs and Canadian Muslims are almost routinely stopped and harassed and treated in a very high-handed and often very reckless way by U.S. border officials.
But as a Canadian citizen, wouldn't the responsibility of the U.S., even if they wanted to deport him, would be to send him to Canada?
Well, the most logical thing under international law would have been to send him back to Canada. I mean, the next logical thing would have been to send him to Zurich. if the Americans did not want to have Mr. Arar in the country for any reason, it would have been quite simple to simply let the Canadian government know that Mr. Arar was not welcome in Canada, that Mr. Arar was not welcome in the United States, and then send him back to Canada. It's very strange that they would take the liberty of sending a man back to a place, back to his place of birth, where he could face foreseeable harm.
Michael Ratner, you were at the Center for Constitutional Rights. What right does a Canadian citizen have in a case like this? Just absolutely nothing?
Well, you know, he should have the right to have the Canadian consulate notified immediately upon his arrest or his taking into custody. They didn't do that. The Canadians took a week at least to find out, so they couldn't defend his rights. I mean, it's obviously an extremely outrageous case. It may not be typical of what's happening to Canadian citizens, but it's typical, like the last story about Alex, of what's happening to non-citizens, which is the executive feels they can pick people up, not take them into courts, and simply do what they want with them at their will. This case was so bad that we actually had no idea where he was for a while, and neither did the Canadian government. We kept pestering the United States, where is he, where is he? So did the Canadians. We didn't know whether he was here or in Syria or where they'd sent him to. We were about to file a habeas corpus petition just to find out where he was, what jail he was in. And just then we found out he had been taken back to Syria, where he hasn't been for 14 years. Understand that. 14 years. The guy hasn't been there. The U.S. just picks him up, sends him back.
Michael, in terms of these mass deportations that are occurring, we're hearing about 3 to 4 Pakistanis a day being picked up on the streets. I mean, we clearly haven't had mass deportations of this type since going back, I guess, to 1950s during the McCarthy era, the Operation Wetback, when close to 2 million Mexicans were deported in massive deportations. Do we have any figures at all as to the dimensions of this of these mass deportations that are occurring?
You know, we don't have very good figures because, first of all, Ashcroft, the last time he gave us any figures was in November when he said 1,200 people were picked up, 700 were remaining in jail. Muslim groups tell me as many as 3,000 have been picked up and either in jail or have been deported back. It could be many, many more because this is all in secret. We brought cases first to get the names. We won that right, but the government appealed. We brought cases to get access for attorneys. You know, we've been unable really to break the stranglehold the U.S. has on both secrecy here of the names and secrecy of the proceedings. And it's been very, very bad for lawyers really trying to represent these people.
Riyad Saluji, what are you recommending to people in Canada, Canadian citizens who are from Iran, Iraq, Libya, Syria, Sudan, Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, or Yemen with this travel advisory that has been issued by the Canadian government, although it sounds like they've lifted it?
Well, you know, we're recommending exactly what the Canadian government has been recommending in the travel advisory, which is for people to be very circumspect and very careful before they travel to or through the United States and to really weigh the pros and cons and the costs and benefits of doing that. You know, the Canadian government issued the travel advisory, and there were assurances from the United States that Canadian governments would that Canadian citizens would not be profiled on the basis of their place of birth. The U.S. government then turned around and said that those assurances, you know, were not in fact concrete at all, and there was not any change of policy. Most Canadian Muslims and Arabs simply will not travel to the United States because even if the assurances are still good, there are about 1 million ways to profile Arabs and Muslims. There are many ways to go around this this idea of of where you're born.
Well, Riyad Saluji, we are going to move now from talking about Muslims and Arab Americans and Arab Canadians to immigrants who continue to face tremendous obstacles. On October 13th, while the mainstream media in this country was covering the D.C. sniper 24 hours a day, the bodies of 11 Mexican and Honduran undocumented immigrants were discovered in an airless train car in Iowa. In Arizona, at least 169 Mexican migrants have died crossing the desert since January of this year. The Sandpoint Company is being investigated for unsafe labor practices after the September 12th death of 14 Guatemalan and Honduran workers who died in a van accident in Maine. And thousands of undocumented workers die every year in the United States in accidents of migration, unsafe workplaces, and as victims in racial hate crimes.
So one of the many immigrants who have died without a face or a name in this country, the Tepeyac Association of New York has organized the Mexico City to New York Guadalupe Torch Run. Runners carrying the torch left Mexico City on October 26th. Members of communities all along the road north have taken their turns moving the torch and its message forward. Last night at 9 p.m., the torch crossed the border from Matamoros, Mexico, into Brownsville, Texas. Mario Najera, one of the organizers of the torch run, joins us on the phone from Brownsville.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, Mario.
Hello.
Can you tell us what's happening right now where you are in Brownsville, the ceremony that's taking place?
Well, yesterday night at we crossed around 10 p.m. Central Time. What we had was the youth and people carrying a torch in procession from Matamoros over the Gateway International Bridge into Brownsville, Texas. It was a great night. We had a lot of people, hundreds of people at the ceremony, and it turned out to be a wonderful, wonderful event.
And Mario, what kind of attention has the torch run gotten along the route from the mass media?
Well, we've had great coverage from the Mexican side. The torch has run only on the until last night. It's been only it's going through Mexico. We've had great publicity with all the major stations in Mexico have been covering. Now we get in the U.S. We hope we haven't got much coverage, and we're hoping to start the momentum to get a lot more press coverage.
The torch will continue north through Texas. A demonstration for immigrants' rights in Washington, D.C., then on to New York, where it will arrive on December 12th. And what are your plans for New York City?
Well, along the route, we're carrying a torch, and our message is for the dignity of a people divided by a border. We want to show that these youth have a voice, and their voice is that they want. We're fighting for permanent amnesty for all immigrants, and this is a Mexican event, but a particular Mexican event. But we are fighting for all undocumented immigrants to have the. All their human rights, which are not being respected as of right now. And in New York City, on December 12th, is the last day, is the day of Our Lady of Guadalupe, and that's where we plan to end the event, arriving and delivering that message to New York City.
Well, we want to thank you for being with us, Mario Najera, speaking to us from Brownsville, just over the border from Mexico. And that does it for Democracy Now!'s War and Peace today, our special on immigrants. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Anna Noguera, and Alex Wolf. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer and music maestro, sitting in for Anthony Sloan, who continues to recuperate. If you want to get a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-881-2359, 1-800-881-2359. You can go to our website at www.democracynow.org. Look forward to seeing people at investigative reporter Seymour Hersh's speech tonight at State University of New York Stony Brook Stoller Auditorium at 7 p.m. That's investigative reporter Seymour Hersh. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!